This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. We're taking a moment to celebrate women and all that they carry at work, in relationships, in families, and in the many roles they hold every day. Women have played a strong role in my life. I was raised by a single mother. She worked multiple jobs at once, and I can't imagine how difficult I was to deal with as a child. But somehow, my mom and a village made it work. I'm sure some of our listeners can also think of someone like that in their own lives. Often the strongest people in our lives are usually the ones holding everything together, which also means they are the last ones to get support themselves, or who might need someone to talk to the most. And that's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp has quality therapists who work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12 plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means they typically get it right the first time. And if you're not happy with your match, you can switch to a different therapist at any time from their tailored recommendations. They also have great client reviews. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy program, having served over 6 million people globally, and it works, with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. Your emotional well-being matters. Find support and feel lighter in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. Have you ever started a new project and then introduced it to the world? It's not just hard, it's terrifying. So much work goes into this thing that you're not entirely sure will work out, and it can be hard to make that leap of faith. Trust me, I know. When Troy and I launched this podcast, we had no idea what we were doing. What if no one listens? What if I make a fool of myself? What if no one buys our products? And believe me, all that bad stuff happened. But I'm happy that we took that leap of faith. We had a lot of tools to help us along the way, and one of the best decisions we made was to have a partner like Shopify on our side to help. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., from household names like American Hauntings to brands just getting started. Get the word out like you have a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. And what if you get stuck? Well, Shopify is always around to share advice with their award-winning 24/7 customer support. And you can trust me, my job is to literally try and anticipate how people online might be confused or break technology or interact with products. And I really, truly love Shopify's products. It's time to turn those what-ifs into with Shopify today. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/hauntings. Go to shopify.com/hauntings. That's shopify.com/hauntings. Shopify, making commerce better for everyone.
The date when a shaft of divine light came down from the heavens and transformed Franz Edmund Creffield from an obscure backwater evangelist into the prophet Joshua II in all his glory remains a mystery. We also don't know the exact spot where this spiritual ordination occurred, but we do know that it was in 1903. And we also know the city where this miracle occurred was Corvallis, Oregon. History has shown us that trouble tends to follow in the wake of modern-day prophets as naturally as water runs downhill. And if the prophet has a face covered with an Old Testament beard and a chronic need to chase after the skirts of young women, then the trouble is sure to be multiplied and, of course, lurid and salacious too. This particular backwoods prophet had both the beard and the taste for women, but it was said that he also had tremendous power. In fact, when he raised his voice in holy anger, as he did on one memorable occasion, the city of San Francisco shook horribly, then fell, trembling and smoking into ruins, becoming one of the greatest disasters that America has ever known. Welcome to American Nightmares, the podcast dedicated to America's history of horror. Through sinister tales of murder, madness, mayhem, spirits, scandals, and sins, I'll be presenting the origins of American terror with true accounts of diabolical witches, murderous madmen, haunted houses, death and dying, and stories of revenge and despair that have been torn from the pages of our haunted past. As you're aware from previous episodes, we've been exploring the diabolical figure of the devil, but this episode is not so much about the devil himself, but serves as a sort of warped sequel to an earlier episode that marked the rise of the Pentecostal movement in American history, although this one is, well, a little different. American Nightmares is written, performed, and produced by Troy Taylor. That's me. And I want to thank you for joining me for episode 14, The Holy Rollers Sex Cult. Mid-century crime writer Stuart Holbrook wrote that when driving up the lush green Willamette Valley from Portland to Corvallis, Oregon, it's no surprise that this region once produced a mad prophet. It's amazing, Holbrook adds, that there haven't been more of them. These lush valleys, where scores of immigrants traveling in creaking covered wagons reached the end of the Oregon Trail. It was here they shouted glory to God and drove their stakes, naming their settlements Amity, Home, Salem, Aurora, and Corvallis, which is said to mean heart of the valley. Here among the many creeks is rich soil where vegetables grew as large as the pictures on seed packets. Fruit hangs heavy from the trees. Grass and clover grow thick enough to stop the wheels of powered farm machinery. The climate is damp and mild, and there's hardly ever more than a trace of snow. The woods are filled with groves of Douglas fir, which had already been tall and mighty before the white settlers ever arrived. To the east is the backbone of Oregon, the peaks of the Cascades. On the west are the Coast Range Mountains, which usually hang faintly in the mist, softened by the haze. Brooding, dark, faraway hills that can make almost any man believe in God. In the heart of the valley, living up to its name, is Corvallis, the home of Oregon State College and a neat, clean community that serves as the seat of Benton County. It's a quiet town today, and in fact, it always was. There was only a short time, during the days of Joshua II, when signs and omens were everywhere, and when blood ran hot and fast in Corvallis. Franz Krefeld arrived in town in 1902. He was a 35-year-old Salvation Army worker, smooth-shaven, short, with brown hair and eyes, and a slight accent left over from being born and raised in Germany. A few months after his arrival, Krefeld either quit or was invited to leave the Salvation Army. There are no details about what occurred, but whatever it was, Krefeld probably decided it was time for him to start his life over again. He was old enough to be wise, but young enough to be energetic, and he had a lot of ideas rolling around in his sex-addled brain that often clouded his thinking. But now he saw things clearly. He decided to go off into the wilderness and let God instruct him on what he should do next. Finding a wilderness wasn't hard. He simply chose the closest one, and there he went to wander and gain the wisdom he needed. No one knows how long he was gone because no one really paid attention, but it must have been at that time when that golden shaft of light from God traveled through space and time, pierced the atmosphere, dodged some clouds and tree branches, and struck Franz Krefeld, who was probably naked at the time. By the time the new prophet emerged from the woods, he was sporting a wild patch of beard that would eventually flow down over his chest, spreading to the left and right. His unkempt reddish-brown hair would grow down over his shoulders, hanging down to the middle of his back, matted and dreadlocked in a way that made him look insane, or made him look like a mad prophet of God. But he was Franz Krefeld no longer. He was now Joshua II, the sole prophet of the Church of the Bride of Christ. Even the tone of his voice had changed. It was no longer the voice of a soft-spoken Salvation Army worker, but the booming voice of muffled thunder. In that voice, many came to believe was the authority of God. Corvallis at the time, despite its handful of churches, was said to be lacking in spiritual life, at least as far as most of the local women were concerned. In those days, there were no movies, no television, and little for the bored women of the town to do. Many of them were tired of their mundane lives in which each day was the same. Cook, clean, care for the children, go to church, go home, and then wake up and do it all again the next day. Prophet Joshua likely recognized the need these women had. They needed a purpose, a new religious philosophy that called out to them, and most of all, they needed hope. And Prophet Joshua's hope came with a lot of big promises. When he returned from the wilderness, Joshua was said to have possessed a magnetic, if not hypnotic, personality. Within a month, he had a sizable cult of converts. It all happened so quietly that most of the men in town had no idea it was happening at all. The first meetings were held openly in the homes of the converts, of whom at least six were men. Initially, the prophet seemed to have no particular message, other than that the ways of the world were wrong and needed to change. One by one, the male converts lost interest and drifted away, leaving Joshua and his right-hand man, Brother Brooks, to carry on with a steadily increasing flock of girls and women. It wasn't long before the meetings in the homes of converts were being held in the afternoons when the men were out of the house at work. But despite the secrecy and the devotion of his followers, whispers about the afternoon services eventually leaked out. Apparently, after pulling down all the blinds in the meeting place, Joshua would begin to chant, swaying, waving his arms, and calling on what he called, quote, full spirit, to descend on the meeting. The girls and women began to sway also. They chanted, they moaned, and they spoke in tongues, like the so-called Holy Roller churches did, speaking to God in an unknown language. Then suddenly, like the sound of thunder, the prophet's voice boomed out. Vile clothes be gone, he cried. And then Joshua removed all his clothing. Without any urging, the women who were present did the same, removing dresses, shirtwaists, stockings, and corsets with as much speed as they could manage. They continued to chant and moan as they did so. Roll ye sinners, roll, thundered Joshua, and the women fell to the floor and rolled and thrashed about with Joshua and Brother Brooks rolling around right next to them. Soon the doctrines of Joshua's cult began to be formed. He'd already announced that he and his followers were the Church of the Bride of Christ, and he soon let it be known that the Lord had commanded him to select from among them she who was to become the mother of the second Christ. Well, it was soon apparent to the faithful that Joshua was going about his quest for a second mother in a very thorough manner, sleeping with all the women in the cult in the search. Often it would take several sessions before Joshua knew if the woman was the chosen one or if he needed to keep searching. He kept nothing secret from the female candidates, though, and often had sex with them right out in the open, in front of an audience. And while several married women left the cult at this point, taking their daughters with them, most remained, and new women appeared at every meeting. So many came, in fact, that Joshua felt the need for more room. On Kiger Island, located in a nearby river, with women and girls helping, he built a large tent using poles covered with tree boughs. The boughs were woven together tightly, and the entrance was hidden behind a canvas curtain. Their hands scratched and torn and covered with the sap of fir trees, but with their eyes shining with the light of the gospel, girls as young as 14 and women as old as 55 worked on the wooded island. Some brought small tents that were set up, while others built small shelters of their own. Throughout the summer of 1903, meetings were held on the island almost every afternoon, and the sound of chanting, moaning, and speaking in tongues could be heard across the water. In time, as the weather brought cooler temperatures and heavy rains, a replacement began to be needed for the island retreat. A new and suitable spot was found in the Corvallis home of Orlando V. Hurt, a respected businessman and member of one of the town's pioneer families. Locals were shocked to see a large sign appear over the door to his house one day. It read, "Positively no admittance except on God's business." A smaller sign, which attached to the gate, repeated the warning. The town of Corvallis, after this, wasn't going to be quiet for long. Soon, an article appeared in the local Times newspaper that read, "Certain aspects of religious fanaticism have been manifested at the house that are so unusual as to suggest a condition bordering insanity. Walks about the house have been torn away. Much of the furniture of the house has been reduced to ashes in a bonfire held last night in the yard on the theory that God wills it. The shrubbery and fruit trees and all the flowers have been dug up and destroyed. Kitchen utensils have been beaten to pieces and buried. It's reported that the cats and dogs have even been cremated." Joshua was taken to the courthouse for a sanity hearing after the article appeared. But he laughed at the proceedings and told Deputy Sheriff Henderson, quote, "not to talk that way to God's anointed." He was found to be sane, but was advised to leave town. Joshua merely laughed again and walked out of the courthouse. Meanwhile, Mr. Hurt, but apparently not the women in his family, which included his wife Sarah and his daughters May and Maud, decided that he wanted no more of Joshua and his cult. His disenchantment with the cult came immediately after a photograph began to circulate that was taken during one of Joshua's spiritual orgies on Kiger Island. It was a candid shot, taken with a Brownie camera, that showed Joshua, quite naked, in the middle of a bevy of naked women and girls from the town. Some of them were standing, some of them were rolling on the ground, and many of them were easily identified. The negative, it was said, was soon worn out by making printed copies from it. The unveiling of this scandalous photo caused an immediate uproar in Corvallis, and not just from Orlando Hurt. Angry fathers and shocked husbands had their women and children packed off to the state hospital and to the home for wayward girls. At least 15 members of the cult were taken out of circulation, while others received warnings to which they paid very little attention. Brother Joshua merely laughed at the outrage being voiced by the husbands, fathers, brothers, and cousins in town. But the wounded men of Corvallis decided to take revenge. On the cool evening of January 4th, 1904, a silent band of men crept up to the house where Joshua and Brother Brooks were staying. None of the men were masked, nor was there any attempt to conceal the incident. Nearly all the members of the mob were respected businessmen and city leaders and had no fear of legal repercussions for what they were about to do. Joshua and his crony were taken from the house and dragged out to the edge of town, where a pot of tar was heating over an open fire. The two men were made to strip and were then covered with boiling tar, which caused burns and blisters. Next, they were coated with feathers. a punishment designed to mock and to intimidate, often leaving victims permanently scarred or with severe, long-lasting skin damage. And finally, the two men were warned to stay out of Corvallis. Brother Brooks was never seen again after that, but the same can't be said for the prophet. Sarah Hurt and her daughter Maud searched for and found the feathered Joshua hiding in the woods. They brought him home and slowly removed the coating of tar from his body. And then, a few days later, Joshua married Maud. The marriage was a local sensation, for it's not often that a daughter from a respected family marries a cult leader who's just had tar and feather scraped from his hide. However, the marriage did ease the minds of many of the men in the community, believing that the prophet was now finished with his search for the second mother. But they were wrong. Leaving his new wife with her family in Corvallis, Joshua traveled to Portland to see a married woman named Donna Starr, who had been one of his followers on Kiger Island. She also happened to be Maud's aunt. She and Joshua were discovered having sex by her husband, who swore out a warrant for adultery against the prophet, an illegal offense at the time. The police had been waiting for something like this to happen so that they could arrest Joshua, but they were unable to find him at first. Hoping to encourage a search, the prophet's father-in-law, Orlando Hurt, offered a $150 reward for his arrest. He also paid for Maud's divorce. Things were not going well for Joshua II. 3 months passed with the prophet at large. Then one day in June, Orlando Hurt's son Roy made a startling discovery. While prowling around under the Hurt home in search of a tin can to carry worms in on a fishing trip, he was frightened out of his wits when he suddenly found himself looking into the eyes of a wild-looking bearded man. Joshua had been found. Scrambling out from under the house as quickly as he could, Roy ran screaming for his father, who peered into the gloom under the house for himself and then called the police. When the authorities arrived, officers hauled the prophet from his hiding place. He was, as one of the men told a reporter, a, quote, sight to behold. The Times newspaper reported, naked as to clothes and dirty as a hog, the man was as hairy all over as a water spaniel and was most wonderfully endowed by Mother Nature. His beard grew down to his stomach and was as bushy as a clump of black alder, but he was as thin as a fence rail. He was weak too and could scarcely stand. Now, if you're wondering what the reporter meant when he said that Joshua was, quote, most wonderfully endowed by Mother Nature, he meant that he had a very large penis. One of the officers asked him if he was Creffield, but the trembling man with the long beard responded by standing up as straight as he could when he said, I am Joshua, in what reporters later described as, quote, the voice of a prophet. The officers and Orlando Hurt managed to piece together the weird story. For more than 2 months, the prophet lived under the Hurt home, his presence unknown to the men in the house. He'd existed on jars of fruit and scraps of food that Sarah Hurt and other members of the cult had smuggled to him. He'd thrown away all his clothing before he went into hiding. The only covering he had when pulled from the darkness was a ragged, filthy quilt, which several of the men insisted he keep wrapped around himself. Joshua was locked up in the town jail and was put on trial before Judge Sears in the Portland court. He readily admitted to what the court called improper relations with Mrs. Starr, but he said that such things were not at all improper for a man of God like he was. He told the judge, Christ broke the Sabbath day and the Jews put him to death. I've broken your laws and you will undoubtedly do the same to me. But like Christ, I will rise again and ye shall suffer. In just 12 minutes, or in about the time it took the jury at his trial to walk to the jury room, sit down, get back up and walk back, they brought in a verdict. It was, no surprise, guilty. Judge Sears asked Joshua if he had anything to say before sentence was pronounced, and he did. He had a lot to say. In a rambling yet volatile speech during which he misquoted scriptures and called the saints as witnesses, he told the court and jury that he forgave them, for they knew not what they did. Judge Sears sentenced him to 2 years in the state prison. The prophet said nothing other than "God bless you" as he was taken from the courtroom by sheriff's deputies. He was taken to the state penitentiary in Salem, where he was given the convict number of 4941 and locked in a cell for the next 15 months. He was released in 1906. His beard was gone, his hair was cropped close to his head, and he was not even slightly rehabilitated. He left Oregon and headed south to Los Angeles, a place that was already earning a reputation for being a haven for cults and prophets like the one Joshua had founded a few years earlier. He didn't stay there long, though. He soon made his way to San Francisco. It wasn't long after that when people in Corvallis learned that Joshua was writing letters to 17-year-old Esther Mitchell, who had been one of the faithful at the meetings on Kiger Island. He wrote to her that God had made it clear to him through a direct message from heaven that Esther was to become the second mother. What Esther replied or thought of this announcement is unknown, but events that soon began indicated she was happy about it. The prophet also sent a letter from San Francisco to Orlando Hurt, his former follower and father-in-law in Corvallis. In it, he wrote, "God has resurrected me. I have now got my foot on your neck. God has restored me to my own. I will return to Oregon and gather together all my followers. Place no obstruction in my way, or God will smite you." From San Francisco, the prophet also wrote to his ex-wife, Maud, who was then living in Seattle with her brother, Frank, and his wife. Maud replied to his letter and said that she would remarry Joshua if he would come to Seattle. The prophet, his hair and beard restored, traveled north, and he and Maud were married by an Orthodox minister. He was now ready to make plans to return to the place that had treated him so shabbily. He would, he announced, go to an isolated spot that he knew on the Oregon coast and would establish a colony there for the faithful, a true Garden of Eden, in which his people could live in a manner best suited to them and their beliefs, free from the presence of outsiders. Now, it would, of course, take money to purchase the land for this colony, and he suggested that Maud's brother and sister-in-law sell their home in Seattle and buy the land on the coast for the, quote, glory of God. And amazingly, the Hurts did exactly what he asked. They sold their property in Seattle and bought the patch of land that Joshua directed them to. It was south of Waldport, Oregon, on the Pacific coast, and in 1906 was a very secluded and remote place. The Hurts and Maud were to go there as an advance party. In the meantime, Joshua would seek out his followers, warning them that remaining away from his new Eden would be at their own peril. Peril? Frank Hurt asked. He was not yet familiar with the powers of a genuine prophet. "Yes, peril," Joshua replied and added, "Brother Hurt, I have called down the wrath of an angry God on these modern Sodoms of Seattle, of Portland, of San Francisco, of Corvallis itself. My faithful will return to the fold, all of them. They will leave all behind them, their scoffing fathers, their brothers, their husbands, and come to our Eden." And then, on the morning of April 17, 1906, according to the story, he pronounced an awful curse. "A curse, O God, on San Francisco, on Portland, on Corvallis, on Seattle." With that curse still ringing in their ears, the advance party boarded a train in Seattle that was bound for Newport, Oregon, the nearest railroad station to Eden. The following day, April 18th, Joshua returned to Oregon. He avoided Corvallis, where he would have to change cars, by getting off the train at Airlie and taking a wagon to Wren, where he boarded a train for Newport. He was met at the depot by his wife and the Hurts, who were shocked and stunned as they tried to tell him about the telegraph messages that had arrived that day, detailing the destruction of San Francisco by earthquake and fire. Joshua smiled smugly. "I knew it," he said quietly. "I knew that God would respond. The other cities of the plain will be next. We must rouse the faithful before it's too late." And his followers were roused just the way that he wanted. When a prophet possesses the power to shake a big city to pieces, it's no surprise when people start paying attention to him. Joshua sent word through the mail to Corvallis, and within 24 hours, workers on the Corvallis and Eastern Railroad were baffled by all the passengers, all of them female, heading for the end of the line at Newport. There were women with babies, middle-aged women with grown daughters, women alone, and girls who, as it turned out, ran away from home. Most of all, the trainmen were struck with and remembered a slim, fair-haired beauty named Esther Mitchell, who would soon be in the newspaper headlines throughout the West. There were two trains that left Corvallis each day, and over the next several days, every train held a few more women and girls who were on their way to the Garden of Joshua. Well, the people of Waldport put no stock in the prophet, not even after rumors spread about the terrible curse that had wrecked San Francisco. They were openly hostile to the cult, but 90 miles away in Corvallis, Joshua's call had sounded loud and clear. Teenage girls who left home for school disappeared. Husbands returned home to find their wives gone, at least one of them carrying a six-week-old baby. Another husband woke up to find a note pinned to his pillow that told him that his wife had taken $2 from his wallet when she left home. She'd waited until after dark so that her children didn't see her leave and cry to go with her. She told him that she knew the money she'd taken wouldn't pay the entire fare to get her where she wanted to go, but her devotion to Joshua was so great, she'd happily walk the final 40 miles. Meanwhile, at the garden, the prophet was receiving more revelations. One message told him that Corvallis would be the next sinful city to be destroyed. Another directed all the members of the cult to burn their clothing and begin wearing a, quote, holy wrapper, which was described as sort of a heavy bathrobe. A huge fire was started, and the screaming, moaning women threw their, quote, vile finery into the flames and dressed themselves in the wrappers that Joshua provided. But walking around in bathrobes wasn't the worst thing about the new Garden of Eden. The living conditions were horrendous. Everyone slept on the ground, huddled under crude lean-tos and leaking wigwams. Food, what little there is, was cooked over campfires. There were between 40 and 50 women and girls living in the commune with the two men. By April 26th, at least one man back in Corvallis had learned the whereabouts of Joshua and the women. This man's young daughter had disappeared, and a subsequent investigation showed that she'd walked most of the way to Newport, which was 80 miles on foot, then down the coast road to the prophet's compound. Her father was soon in pursuit, and when he reached Newport, he stopped only long enough to buy a .22 caliber revolver and a box of cartridges. Unfortunately, this delay caused him to miss the ferry across Jacana Bay. He arrived at the dock just as the boat was pulling away. And that was when he spotted Joshua and several of the women from the cult on the ferry boat. The man immediately pulled his new gun, aimed it at the bearded prophet, and as the women around him screamed, the gun only clicked 5 times in a row. On the boat, Joshua merely smiled. He told the women, "You see, no man can kill Joshua." They were now certain they'd witnessed another example of the prophet's power. But in truth, it was a mistake by the clerk at the hardware store where the man bought the gun who actually saved the prophet's life. The clerk had sold the man a centerfire revolver and rimfire cartridges, which don't work together. "That's why the son of a bitch is still alive," the irritated father later said. But he wasn't the only angry husband or father in Corvallis. Plans began to be made to finish off Joshua once and for all. Traveling alone and in groups of two and three, they took the train to Newport. Heavily armed, they crossed on the ferry to Waldport, only to learn that Joshua knew they were coming, because he'd been on his way to Seattle and had spotted them on the road. He'd hid in the woods to let several of the groups pass him by. News of the missing prophet reached Corvallis, and a young man named George Mitchell, the 21-year-old brother of Esther, who was mentioned earlier, heard the news. Revolver in his pocket, he hurried to Albany, thinking he might catch the prophet there, waiting for a train, but he was too late. Joshua and his wife Maud had tickets to Seattle and had already departed. Mitchell had to stay overnight in Albany to catch the morning train, and he arrived in Seattle on May 17, 1906. Whether Mitchell knew where to look for Joshua in Seattle or not is unclear, but what is clear is that he eventually found him. Around 8 o'clock that morning, Joshua and Maud left the rooming house where they were staying and walked down 2nd Avenue. At Cherry Street, they turned and walked to 1st Avenue. In front of Quick's drugstore, there was a coin-operated scale. And as Maud stepped onto the machine, Joshua stood next to her, looking into the store window. Behind them, though, was George Mitchell. He hurried along the street, stepped up quickly behind the prophet, placed the muzzle of his revolver behind Joshua's left ear, and fired. The prophet never made a sound. He simply slumped over and collapsed onto the sidewalk. Maud screamed, and she flew at Mitchell like a wildcat, screeching and clawing at him and trying to strip the gun out of his hands. Mitchell pushed her away, but made no attempt to flee. Maud left him and bent over her husband, whose blood was now pooling beneath his head. He died without making a sound. He never even moved, not even a shudder. Mitchell just stood there, holding the gun in his hands. When a police officer came around a corner and hurried toward him, he silently handed the gun to the cop. Maud, frantic at first, quickly calmed down. She pointed at the prophet on the sidewalk and said to the policeman, "This man is my husband, Joshua the prophet. He will rise in 3 days and walk." Sure he will, the cop replied. At the police station, Mitchell was calm, even happy. He was allowed to send a telegram, and it went to Orlando Hurt in Corvallis. The wire read, quote, "I got my man, and I'm in jail here." Despite protests from Frank Hurt and his wife, who had hurried to Seattle from Eden, the body of the dead prophet was turned over to the Bonnie Watson Undertaking Parlor. On May 9th, they buried him at Lakeview Cemetery, with only Maud at the grave. No services were conducted. The great prophet Joshua II was gone. But his story wasn't over. As Seattle's King County prepared to prosecute George Mitchell, newspaper readers were focused on the city where the trial would be held. Everyone seemed to have forgotten the prophet's Garden of Eden, 300 miles to the south. And things were going badly there. On May 15th, George Hodges, who owned a lumber ship, was looking over some old trees not far from Waldport along the coast. It was a cold, windy day, and when he emerged from the forest and onto the beach, he was startled by what he saw. Huddled around a struggling fire were 5 women and young girls. One of them held a baby in her arms, and they were all dressed in some kind of outlandish robes. They were camping out on the beach, and immediately Hodges could see they were starving. Some of them turned out to be too weak to stand. They were grouped around a frayed and torn tent, and they told the startled man that they were followers of Joshua, the prophet who had recently destroyed San Francisco. Well, Hodges was an avid newspaper reader and began to realize what he'd stumbled on. He asked the women where this prophet was, and they told him that Joshua had gone north to Queen Charlotte Islands off the coast of British Columbia, where he was looking for a new site for their Garden of Eden. "Well, that prophet of yours is dead," Hodges told the women. "He was shot and killed in Seattle a week ago." The women laughed at him. He couldn't be dead. He was impossible to kill. They'd seen a man try to shoot him once, and the gun had failed. You couldn't kill Joshua. Well, convinced the women were out of their minds, and learning they'd had nothing to eat in 2 weeks except for a few crabs and mussels, Hodges left them the provisions he carried in his pack and went to Newport. He then telephoned the authorities in Corvallis and reported what he'd found at the failing Garden of Eden. Soon, expeditions of husbands, fathers, and brothers were on their way to the coast to bring home the women who'd been stranded there. At the same time, the trial of George Mitchell in Seattle was now underway. Within days, it started to appear on the front pages of newspapers all over the country. Readers couldn't get enough of the lurid stories and the revelations that emerged about the late and lusty prophet, and they made any competing murder cases seem tame in comparison. During the trial, William D. Gardner, superintendent of the Oregon Boys and Girls Aid Society, testified that a large number of young girls had been sent to his institution from Corvallis by their parents. He said that most of these girls had described, quote, criminal relations with the prophet, but didn't believe there was anything wrong with it since Joshua was searching for the mother of the second Christ. Creffield was a degenerate of the worst sort, wrote John Manning, the district attorney of Portland, in a letter to Kenneth McIntosh, who was prosecuting Mitchell. And he added, quote, he practiced unspeakable brutalities on ignorant and unsophisticated girls. A Corvallis resident testified that Esther Mitchell, George's sister, had been one of those sent to the Boys and Girls Aid home to get her away from Joshua. When released, she immediately sought out the prophet again. She was obsessed, the witness concluded. Esther herself attended her brother's trial. Day after day, she sat there, and observers noted her lack of emotion as she watched and listened with no expression on her face. Another witness told the story of his daughter, who he said left Oregon State College in the last term of her fourth year because Joshua told her that all learning was the work of the devil. The girl's mother was also obsessed with the prophet and had broken every dish in their home except for some plain white crockery because she believed that decorated dishes were sinful. Evidence given during several days of the trial caused the judge to clear the courtroom of spectators. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer newspaper stated that, quote, no such testimony has ever been given in a King County court. And the newspaper was correct about that. The judge and the other officers of the court were subjected to detailed descriptions about why Joshua and his followers were dubbed a sex cult. It was shocking stuff for 1906. There were discussions of Joshua's allegedly superhuman virility and the festivities on Kiger Island, where women, old, young, and in between, danced and rolled around naked on the ground and indulged in orgies. One witness described not only Joshua's, quote, godlike penis, but also his exhibitionist need to show it off and his desire for bondage and public humiliation. One former member reported that while on the island, Joshua had a punishment tent where he tied women down and, quote, whipped the devil out of them until the promises they made to be good girls were expressed to his satisfaction. George Mitchell conducted himself with quiet dignity during the trial. A large delegation came from Corvallis led by Orlando Hurt, who provided bail and support for Mitchell. Women brought flowers to him in the courtroom each day until the judge finally ordered them to stop. Mitchell's statement was simple. He told the court, quote, I came here to kill this man because he ruined my two sisters. I've completed my work. From the first, it was clear that Mitchell's attorneys, Silas Shipley and W.H. Morris, planned to present justifiable homicide and temporary insanity as defense. It's likely that when the trial ended on July 10th, no one was surprised when a verdict of not guilty was reached by the jury. Mitchell was mobbed by friends and well-wishers, although his sister said nothing and left the courtroom without going near him. 2 days later, Mitchell and his brothers, Fred and Perry, went to Seattle's King Street Station to catch the 4:30 afternoon train. The waiting room was crowded with summer tourists and several dozen people who'd come to Seattle from Corvallis to witness the trial. People were happy and laughing, and the scene was almost carnival-like. Fred Mitchell spotted Esther standing near a pillar in the station, seemingly not paying attention to what was happening around her brother. She was leaning against the post, a jaunty new sailor-style hat on her head. Her skirt was a bit short, coming almost to the tops of her shoes. A white satin bow was around her neck, the ends of it streaming down over a white shirt waist. She carried a light coat over one arm. Fred left his two brothers and went to Esther, asking her, wasn't she going to say goodbye to George? The girl agreed with a nod. She walked back over to the others with Fred, and while she took George by the hand, she didn't respond to his greeting. The four Mitchells then walked toward the gate of the train shed as the station announcer called for the train from Seattle to Portland and points between. Then the silent Esther suddenly moved. Reaching under her coat with her right hand, she produced a small pearl-handled revolver, and moving so quick that Fred had no time to think or act, she pressed the muzzle of the gun behind George's left ear and pulled the trigger. Like the prophet Joshua, George sank to the marble floor of the station without a sound. In the noisy, crowded station, the gunshot went mostly unnoticed, but a police officer named John T. Mason had witnessed the shooting. He took the gun from Esther's hand and placed her under arrest. George was already dead. At the Seattle police station, Esther was calm, dry-eyed, and showed no emotion about what she'd done. She had to kill her brother, she said. George had killed Joshua, and she had avenged him. She pointed out that she'd shot him in the same place he'd shot the prophet. Under questioning, it was discovered that Esther and Maud Crefield, the prophet's widow, had planned to kill George if he was freed by the court. Detectives were sent to bring Maud to the station, and the two women told the same story. Maud bought the gun, and Esther did the killing. She'd been waiting for her brothers at the station, knowing they'd be going home by train. This new turn of events shook Seattle, as well as Corvallis. Maud and Esther were both arrested and held for trial. Esther was found not guilty due to a, quote, unsound mind, and was committed to the Washington State Asylum. Maud was held in the county jail while she waited for her trial to begin, but apparently decided that she couldn't live without the prophet. She somehow got her hands on a large dose of strychnine, and her cold, stiff body was found in her bunk the next morning. 3 years later, in April 1909, Esther was released from the asylum. She was graciously invited to live with Maud's parents, the Hurt family. After losing their own daughter, they, more than others, understood what Esther had been through. Unfortunately, it wasn't long before West Coast newspapers began printing lurid and almost completely untrue stories about her. She later left Corvallis behind and moved with the Hurt family to Waldport. By 1912, she'd moved out on her own and rented a small cottage near the community of Ocean View, where her brother Paul lived. She spent the next few years slowly rebuilding her life with the support of her remaining brothers and sisters who had forgiven her for George's murder. Then on April 7th, 1914, Esther married a man named James Berry in Newport. The two had known each other for several years, but Esther proved once again that she had terrible taste in men. While Esther worked hard to rebuild her reputation, James was in the lifelong process of destroying his own. This was his third marriage, and it would not be his last. He'd been married the first time to a 16-year-old named Clara King. He was 25 at the time. 1 year later, she gave birth to their son, but then 3 years after that, James decided he no longer wanted to be married and obtained a divorce, as well as custody of their son. James married again in 1910, this time to Hortense Johnson, but fell out of love with her not long after she gave birth to their daughter in 1911. They were divorced a year later. Esther met James in 1912. He was friendly with the Orlando Hurt family, and the two met that way and got along well. Their friendship turned to love, and they were wed 2 years later. But that marriage didn't last long. 4 months after their nuptials, Esther was dead. She'd taken her own life. According to her obituary, in the months leading up to her suicide on August 1st, 1914, she was frequently ill and had lost a great deal of weight. After a dinner at home with her husband, her stepson, and a Mrs. Cora Hartley, James went to town and Esther helped Cora wash the dishes and pluck two chickens for the next day's meals before going up to her room at 9:30 p.m. Alone in her bedroom, she wrote a short note, which was more of a last will and testament than an explanation, and then swallowed a dose of strychnine, the same poison used by her friend Maud 8 years earlier. Esther's death finally brought an end to the story of the prophet Joshua and his sex cult of holy rollers. It's a strange tale of religion and crime that's been largely forgotten over the years, but one that still manages to be disturbing in our modern times. Thanks for checking out the latest episode of American Nightmares, part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. If you like the show, we hope you'll consider checking out the other shows in the network and recommend them to your friends, your family, people you work with, and anyone you think would love them too. To say thanks for that support, we've got a discount code that's just one word, podcast. And that gives you 10% off any books or tours or events you purchase from our online store, which you'll find at AmericanHauntings.net. That website is also home to our books, tours, ghost hunts, dinner events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum. And while that makes American Hauntings sound big, we're really a small business that's grateful for everything you do for us. We couldn't and wouldn't do all this without you, so thank you, and good night, good luck, and I'll see you next time. Thanks.
This episode was brought to you by the American Hauntings Podcast Network.